Hey. My name's Alcoholic Tyler, and I just got really nervous coming up here. I don't really know why, because I know all of you and most of you. But anyway, my sobriety date is August 26, 2014. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who's here, and he has a sponsor who's here, so I have sponsors, and I sponsor other men. And this is my home group, YPG, and I'm really not sure what to talk about. I was trying to think about like what I was going to talk about, but she was speaking and she kept saying like ice skating and going down dark alleys, and I couldn't like stay in my own head. It kept drawing me out. Anyway, my drinking story is really not, it's not interesting. There's nothing really glamorous or awesome or crazy that happened for it. So I guess I'll just talk about like little snapshots of what it was like for me. I remember when I was 19 is when I started drinking alcoholically. I don't remember what my first drink was. I know that when my first time drinking was probably in high school, but it didn't really, it didn't do much for me. I felt like it was morally wrong or something. Like, I always had this idea that I was supposed to be a straight-A student and do great things and all this other shit that my dad told me. He was like, I remember my dad used to tell me every day, set the example, don't follow it, son. And I used to be like, all right, Dad, I got you. But anyway, so when I was 19, I moved in with a roommate, and he used to drink like an 18 case of beer every day. And all growing up, I always felt like a turd. I don't know why. I had a really big like ego, but really low self-esteem. So I always felt like I wasn't good enough. You know, I wasn't good enough at sports. I wasn't smart enough in school. I wasn't handsome enough. Just all this stuff like going on in my head. And it didn't hit me until I moved into this kid that like if I drank enough of the beer in a short enough period of time, that all that would go away. It would just get really quiet. And I loved it. And so, my first like month of, after that, I think I was living in, I was going to UCF, and I'd been there for like a month. And then at the beginning of the second month, like I just started drinking in the morning. I take a couple shots because, like in my head, I was like, "This is my medicine." You know what I mean? This is like what's gonna make me normal. So that's the mentality I had. So I started drinking in the morning. I normally take like a shuttle on the campus because I lived off campus. And then I noticed that when I drank in the morning, it wasn't enough to hold me over through all my classes. So I just, put the bottle in my backpack, like in between some books, and I don't know why, that's not even an accent, I don't know how I messed that word up, books. The hell is that talking about? Oh, yeah. So I had to start bringing it with me, and so I'd go into, I'd either go back, I'd actually start driving, because it would be easier to hide the amount that I was bringing with me in my truck instead of my backpack, which is a great idea. So I'd like go back to my truck and drink some more and, go back to school and go to work. And I don't know, I was doing that for maybe about a solid 8 months. And then it started getting to the point where I was getting sick a lot. I would wake up in the morning and I would just, I would have nothing in my stomach but alcohol, and I'd throw it up, and it'd be like for a straight 8 or 9 hours where I couldn't drink any water, I couldn't eat any food, like I couldn't drink any more alcohol. I'd literally just like sit in my apartment like balled up, like waiting until I could like consume something. I remember I'd be so thirsty, you know what I mean? It was terrible. I'd be so thirsty and I couldn't drink any water, I couldn't eat anything, I was really hungry, and I was just like, I was like poisoned by alcohol. I knew that it had something to do with my drinking, but I refused to believe that it was like a problem that maybe I should look at my drinking. So normally, as soon as I could like get down, half a cup of water, I'd start drinking again. And that's pretty much how I rolled, for that's what I did, man. I would I'd get sick a lot. A lot of times I'd be driving from home to work. I worked on campus, and I would have to pull over at like Pollo Tropical and throw up in their bathroom. I'd have to throw up in bushes on camp. I mean, it was just really pretty sad and pathetic. I went out sometimes, but normally when I'd go out, I would just leave because it's just a lot easier to just, like, get drunk without having to drive and be around other people. I used to get a lot of trouble when I'd drink and be around other people too. Like, bad things would happen. So I just knew that I'd just need to be, it'd be better if I just drank alone. So that's what I did. And then in 2011, I just kind of hold myself in my apartment. I didn't go. I said I wasn't going to talk much about my drinking. Here I am. Anyway, long story short. So that's pretty much how my drinking was. In 2011, I went to a rehab. It was BayCare. And I stayed at my mom's house. She'd picked me up from Orlando and knew that I was in trouble. And I got this leave from school for two semesters for alcoholism. And I had to go to, like, this rehab program and get approved by a doctor to go back. And I remember I just finished the 12 weeks, and they gave me this graduation thing saying I had completed, like, this alcohol thing. And my mom was, like, proud. She, like, framed it. I was like, don't frame that shit. That's terrible. Literally that night, I got drunk, and I was so drunk that I put fish sticks and French fries and I think a couple of Hot Pockets in her oven and set it to, like, 400. And literally, I only had to wait 15 minutes, and I couldn't do it. I blacked out. And the smoke alarms went off in the house. My mom woke up, like, couldn't wake me up. There was a fire in the kitchen. It was bad. And so she, like, kicked me out for a little bit, let me back in. I tried to, like, stay sober on my own. The rehab had made me go to AA, and I came here, and it really freaked me out. You know, I remember the first time I went, it was to a meeting over in Brandon, and it was in a church, so that was, like, strike one for me, because I was a pretty hardcore atheist, I'd say. And then I went in, and I remember they had these little banners up of these 12 steps or whatever, and like, after step one, it's just like, God, you know, power greater than yourself, God, and I was like, woo, like, nah. And I just immediately thought it was, like, a Christian cult. And at the end, they, like, held my hand, and they, like, started saying the Lord's Prayer. And I was like, these guys are far out, man. And I never wanted to go back again. And I remember my mom asked me, like, how was your first AA meeting? And I was like, Mom, I feel bad for those people. They're really sick. Like, but I think I just, it's really cool that they have a place that they can go. But it's not for me, Mom. And she was like, all right. You know, she doesn't know anything about being an addict. But anyway, so, you know, another 2-3 years, same shenanigans. Pretty much for the next 3 years until 2014, I'm hiding all my drinking. I don't drink in public at all. I don't tell anybody at all. It's all behind closed doors. It's lying. It's manipulating. It gets to the point to where I can't afford it, so I'm having to take money from work. I remember one time I had wanted to quit drinking for probably 2 years, but I wanted to quit, but I just couldn't. And I remember I gave my wallet and my debit card and, like, everything that I had to my uncle. And I was like, I want you to hold on to this, because if I have any of this, I'm going to drink again. And all I need is my ID. And he's like, all right. He gave me an ID, and he gave me, like, a gas card where I can only buy gas. And it lasted for, like, I don't know, two days of doing it that way. And I ended up finding, I just tore through my apartment and found this, like, this gold necklace and a cross that my mom gave me when I was, like, 3 or 4 years old. I remember I was going to a daycare, and, like, there's some little bastards had, like, jewelry, and I told my mom I want jewelry, so she gave me hers. And I'd kept it this whole time, and it was supposed to mean something to me, but I just saw it and I was like, gold. I took it to the pawn shop. I got $40 for it, and that was enough to get some early times and a couple of Hot Pockets. And I was pretty much set for, like, a good 4 or 5 days. And I mean, that's just how it went, man. It got to the point where it didn't matter if I wanted to quit or whether I wanted to drink or not. No matter what, it seemed like if the thought came into my head that I wanted to drink, I was going to drink. And the cool thing is, though, is that I ended up going back. I went to another detox facility, Turning Point. But I had been going to AA, like, up until then, like, trying to get help. You know, I was starting to get desperate, but I wasn't desperate enough. And I would go in, and I would listen to all these stories, and I'd hear, like, meeting makers make it and all this shit. And what I ended up learning is that meeting makers don't make it, the people that do the steps. The people that take action, which is, like, what I refuse to do, are the people that made it, from my experience. So I actually got a sponsor, and when he asked me if I was willing to do anything, I said yeah. And he asked me how I was on God, and I said, I don't know. And he says, well, there is a God, and it isn't you. And he says, you can believe that I've been sober for 8 years now, and it had nothing to do with you. There's definitely a power greater than you, and that's where you're going to start. And I was like, all right. And then he explained, step three, giving my will and life over to the power of God as I understood him. He said, my will was all of my thoughts, and my life is all my actions that kind of come. They come after the thoughts. And he says, so giving your will and your life is basically, if you have any thoughts at all, you're going to give me a call, and you're going to be talking to people in AA. And I was like, so if I have any thoughts about drinking? And he said, no, if you have any thoughts of your own at all. And I figured, what the hell, man? You know, when I met him, I'd been marksman acted. I lost my job. My bank account was overdrawn, and my credit card was maxed out. And I was staying at my grandma's house. She was like the last person in my family that was going to let me, that still was like in my corner. So I just started doing that, man. I started calling him about what seemed like stupid stuff, and he started taking me through the book and through the steps. And I don't know. I don't know exactly how it happened. You know, I know it says how it worked or whatever, but I learned that I couldn't think my way into getting sober any more than I could think my way into anything, really. You know, I couldn't think myself into being sober. I had to take action. It's just like I can't sit on my couch and eat chips and think my way into like being ripped or something. You know what I mean? You gotta go in the gym and you gotta put in the work. Like, I couldn't think myself into being like a college graduate. Like, you actually have to take action. You have to do the work and all this stuff. I never saw that before, and I learned that in here. You know, and so I learned that if I started taking action, that my thinking would start to change. And that's what my sponsor kept telling me over and over and over again. And I didn't really understand how, but I mean, that's just how, you know, that's just how it worked out for me. I don't know what else to talk about now. I feel like I've hit a dead end. So what it's like now. Okay. So so what it's like now, it's weird. So I talked to my sponsor about this, and he kind of takes the same view. It's like my alcoholism shows up in different ways than going and taking a drink. My alcoholism shows up in ways like, I don't really want to go to a meeting tonight, so I'll just stay home. Or I don't really want to speak tonight, so I'll tell, Stan that I have bad gas or something and I can't speak. Or, you know what I mean? Or like, I don't want to go hang out with my, I don't want to go work with my sponsee tonight. Like, I want to watch football, you know? So that's like me, that, you know, that's just like this mental mind effort that this whole program is. And it like, what I've learned, though, is when I don't do this stuff that I don't want to do, I don't feel good. And that's just the way it is. When I do this stuff that, for me, a gut reaction is to not do it, I normally feel better afterwards. I think the main reason is because, like, doing this kind of stuff gets me out of my own head. You know what I mean? If I hold myself up in my apartment or just, like, work and job, all I'm thinking about the whole time is myself. It's, like, my problems of, like, grass is greener on the other side. If I only made this much more money, I'd have this. And just, like, all kinds of rabbit holes I can go down in my own head. But, you know, if I come to a meeting, a speaker meeting or whatever meeting, and I'm listening to somebody else, like, during that time, I'm not thinking about myself. I'm just listening. Like, when you were speaking earlier, it was like, I was just listening. I went to a men's advance recently, and the guy that was leading it, he's like, for any of you that are confused on meditating is just when you're not thinking about yourself. So if you go to a meeting and you're not thinking about yourself, you're meditating. And I was like, far out, man. Like, that makes it so much easier. I remember when I had, like, 9 months, I'd made a pact with this guy. Like, we're going to call each other every morning and spend an hour meditating and doing all this other shit. And I was just like, I couldn't do it. And I'd beat myself up about it, but I got an out now on that one. Thanks for the men's advance. Did I miss something? No? Are we good? How much time do I have left? I have 25 minutes left? Are you serious? Like, for real? All right. So this guy walks into a bar, and no, I'm just kidding. Let's go. Yeah. All right. I guess we'll just go through the steps. I feel like I've went through 1 through 3 pretty well. The steps, like I said, the step makers are the ones that make it. The ones that don't do the steps normally go out and drink. From just my experience, whatever I say is just me and like the big book. You know, anything else could be bullshit from whatever I'm saying. Step one, admitted I'm powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. That's actually a really good one, because it says in the big book that the first step is conceding to our innermost self that we're alcoholic, right? That's the first step in recovery. And it says that, and that's the first step in recovery, but it's not part of the 12 and 12, so it's like the first thing. So for me, I remember when I came in, this guy Bill O at 164, he said, why do you think you're alcoholic? Like, why are you alcoholic? And I said, when I drink, I can't stop drinking. If I'm drinking around other people, they get hurt or I get hurt, and whatever. And he's like, that's not what makes you an alcoholic. That's like not what an alcoholic is. That's what an alcoholic does. You know what I mean? If I ask you what a duck is, you can't tell me it flies, it poops on your car, and it's really good at swimming. Like, that's not what a duck is. That's what a duck does. And he explained to me that an alcoholic is somebody that has alcoholism. And alcoholism is a two-part disease. And the first one is the allergy to the body, and the second one is the obsession of the mind. And so he started going through like the allergy of the body thing to me. This was like back in 2013. I really wasn't too interested in getting sober. I was just trying to get this chick back. But he was breaking it down to me anyway, and I remembered it, which is pretty awesome. You know, the seed was planted. And he said that, you know, the allergy of the body means that whenever you drink, you develop this phenomenon of craving. And I said, I don't understand how it's an allergy of the body. Like, I don't break out in hives. I don't start sneezing or have a rash or trouble. He's like, an allergy in the dictionary is any abnormal reaction to something. And he says, so when you drink, you have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. He said, when you start drinking, you develop this phenomenon of craving, and that becomes greater than anything else. So that explains why when you only want to have one to take the edge off, or you just want to drink a couple beers, you still end up going back to the store and getting, you know, more early times and drinking until you black out. You know, that's part of the physical allergy. Most people don't do that. They don't develop this phenomenon of craving. And I said, all right. And he said, the second part is you have the obsession of the mind. And this one took me a long time to get. He said that, you know, even when you're not drinking, and this is all out of the doctor's opinion in the big book, so this is nothing new or radical I'm talking about. But he says, you know, even when you're not drinking, you're always thinking about it. And he says, do you understand that? And I was like, yeah. He's like, when you think about, you know, even when you're not drinking, you're thinking about it. And it was true. You know, I remember at probably 3 o'clock every day at work, I would start thinking about what I was going to get, where I was going to get it from. If I didn't have enough money, how I'm going to get enough money to pay for it? Where am I going to drink it at? What am I going to eat while I'm drinking? All this stuff. And he told me that that's why you keep thinking about drinking and then you do it. It's like, so just stopping drinking is not enough. That takes part of the only cure for the physical allergy is if you just stop drinking. That's it. And if you weren't an alcoholic, you could just stop drinking and then that would be the end of it. You'd go on with your life. And he says, but it's twofold. So just stopping is not enough because you still have the mental obsession. He says what AA does and the 12 steps of AA is treats that mental obsession. You know, it tells us in the book, you know, it says it a couple of different ways. In the doctor's opinion, it talks about these people have a psychic change, and then later they call it a spiritual experience. And what I learned from my sponsor taking me through is that spiritual experience and psychic change are the same exact thing. And for a militant atheist like me, it really helped out to think of it as I'm going for a psychic change. You know what I mean? Even though now I have no problem with saying that I had a spiritual experience. And so then when the first time I was introduced into step four, I definitely didn't want to do it. I don't think I've ever talked to anybody that was really excited on their first time being introduced to step four of wanting to do it. And I feel like if I asked you guys to raise your hand that was looking forward to it, you'd be liars. But that's just my opinion. So, but the second and, you know, third time through AA, I wanted to do it because I didn't want to feel the way I did anymore. But I remember my sponsor told me that don't take too much time. And he said to sit down and I feel like this is getting boring. I'm getting bored talking about step four. Anyway, you guys, if you don't know what step four is, look it up in how it works. I think it starts on page 63. And so after that, step five, how much time we got? Huh?
About 15.
Man, time goes slow when you're having fun. I'm just kidding. Stan told me to stay perky, so I'll stay perky for you guys. So yeah, coming up to step five, I thought it was like this really, like, I didn't know what it was, like the first job interview or something. You know what I mean? Like in my head, I just pictured myself wearing like a suit and tie, and I go over to my sponsor's house, and we have like this roasted pork, and then like, and then we go and sit in a room by the fire, you know what I mean? And like, we have this talk, because it says in the big book, like, get ready for a long talk. And I was like, it's going to be a long talk, for sure. And what ended up happening is he called me at like 4:50. I get off work at 5. And he was like, I'm right around the corner from your work, man. How are you doing? And I was like, I'm doing really good. He's like, did you finish your step four? You did your resentments, your fear, and your sex, and your catch-all? You did it all? To the best of your ability? And I was like, yeah, man, I did. He goes, cool. And so then he just drove up, and he's like, let's do it right now. And I was like, man, I was like dirty and in my work clothes. And so we just, you know. So we sat down and did it. It wasn't as special as I thought it was going to be in my head. And I remember after I did it, I didn't feel anything. You know, I felt like some weight was released, but I thought that, like, so like as soon as I did it, I would get this instant gratification. And it wasn't the way it happened. I remember he told me, I'm going to leave now. And he says, you're going to do 6 and 7. And 6 is, as it is in the big book, you're going to read through the proposals we've done so far and make sure you haven't skimped out on anything. And then he said, step 7, after you've waited an hour, is you get on your hands and knees and you read the 7-step prayer out of the book. And I did that. I got on my hands and knees, like, I think I turned most of the lights off in my apartment. I had like one light on, and it was quite a setting. But anyway, so I like got on my hands and knees and I read it out of the book, and like I'm looking up, you know, for like the God to like open up my seal and be like, I'm here. Cause my sponsor's like, dude, he's like, when you ask for God to enter your life, like, he's like, be ready, man. He's like, he's coming. And I was like, is he really? Like, is this, you know, like the boogeyman's coming? He's like, God's coming. And I was like, all right, man. You know what I mean? I'm totally ready for that. Anyway, it didn't happen. And then I told him I did that, and he said, are you sure you didn't miss anything? And I said, I don't think I missed anything. And he says, all right, cool. He says, but think about it, because if you did miss something, you're going to drink again, and for you to drink is to die. And then he hung up the phone, and I was like, oh, shit. And so I didn't sleep much that night, and I remember I was driving to the Turning Point outpatient thing the next day, and I called him, and I told him that there was this kid, David, that I went to kinder care with at La Petite, and his mom worked there, and he used to really annoy me, and so I punched him in the his mom was right in front of us, and she looked the other way, and I punched him in the face, and then when she turned around, he just started hitting me, and he got in a lot of trouble, like he had to be in time. So I told him, it was stupid, I told him 15 minutes, okay. So I told him that, and he was like, all right, man, you know, just keep doing what you're doing. And So by the time I got out of Turning Point, I had started doing amends. So the 8-step, like it says in the book, like we already made our list. when we took our inventory, and the main difference that he pointed out to me is that anything on the 8-step would be something that's not in your sexual inventory, that you're not afraid of, and that you have no resentment towards, but where you've caused harm, it needs to be added on to your 8-step. And he said, I want you to write your 8-step in the order that you want to do the amends, and he said, I want you to put next to it how you think you should do it. And I said, okay. So I did that. And it took me a couple days, and we met again at McDonald's, and he used to always carry this red pen with him. And he did it on my 4-step, too. He just edited it. And so I gave him the list, and he just started, you know, the one that I wanted to do first, he put it at the very bottom. He crossed out how I was going to do it. And he just reemphasized that, I can't cause other people harm to, like, save myself. I really didn't know what the hell he was talking about, but I'm glad that he helped me through the steps, or else I would have screwed it up. All the first ones I wanted to do were to, like, girls, like, ex-girlfriends, and I wanted to do them all in person. He was like, nah. Like, he's like, letter that you don't send, another letter that you don't send, check that you mail, and that's how it was. But, you know, the craziest thing is one of the ones that I was most afraid to do was to an ex that I had in Orlando, and he just made me write a short letter, not overly detailed, just really short and sweet, basic, you know, 9 stuff, making amends, like, don't apologize, say what you did, say that it was wrong, say that you're willing to do whatever needs to be done to change that if you can. And then I sent a check, because I stole a lot from this person. And then they wrote me back, like, a month later. I was really nervous about it. And not all my amends went well, but I was really worried about this one. And I remember I got a letter back about a month, and I kept watching my checking account to see if the check would go through, to know that she read it, and also because money was tight, and this was probably more than I should have sent, so I had to be prepared. And then I got a letter, and it just said that... I'm glad you're doing well. I'm surprised that you're alive. Please keep doing what you're doing. I didn't cash your check because I feel like you probably need it more than I do right now. I'm doing well. And plus, I invited you in and let you do those things. So she said, you know, just keep doing what you're doing. And I'm glad you're well. And I was like, man. You know what I mean? That was like the first amends where I was like a little teary, you know? And but then some amends didn't go like that. I remember there was an aunt that I caused a lot of harm to. I lived with for a while. And then I was trying to stay sober. But when I started drinking, I started hiding it from her. I started taking things from her and doing all. And I went and made amends to her. And I said, listen, what I did was wrong. And I went to specifics for her and told her what I did and asked if I could make it any better, and she was like, I'm still pissed off at you, and that's really cool that you're sober, but I'm not. And it's just kind of like how it is. I forget your name, I'm so sorry. Angela. Like Angela was saying earlier, like amends is something she's still working on. For me, is something my sponsor said, dude, there's just, it's going to be, and for me too, is like I keep adding stuff on to the amends list. I guess that's another thing I can talk about, you know, being sober, is I'm not perfect at this stuff as much as I would like to think that I am, because my ego wants me to think that I am. I remember when Stan asked me to speak tonight, he was like, how much time do you have? And I said, I have 2 years, but experience-wise, I'd say a solid 20. And he's like, definitely say that tonight. But anyway, that's not cool. You know, that's an out-of-the-control ego. And so what happens because of that is I have to add, I keep having to make amends, and it sucks. But what I've learned over time is that that normally, like, my best thinking still, you know, I hear Glenn say it all the time, my best thinking gets me drunk, and I'm sorry, dude. That was so mean to do your voice. Glenn's awesome, by the way. Glenn's the main reason why I'm sober today. But my best thinking does get me drunk. And sometimes I fall into that pitfall where I start believing stuff in my own head. And then without even realizing, I start hurting other people and doing stuff I have to make amends for. So, I mean, for me, it's just nip it in the butt, do it quickly. Normally when I do something wrong today, which is kind of cool from practicing this stuff, because I feel like steps 1, through 9 is just a trial run where you learn, and then you keep doing that through the maintenance steps of 10, 11, and 12, and you just get better at it, just like a fine-tuned engine. And which So that's how amends went and are. 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admitted it. I've gotten better at the promptly part. Oh man, 1 minute. And I'm definitely gotten better at being prompt with that. And then 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve conscious contact with God. I pray in the morning. I have a God of my own understanding. It's not a religious God. It's a spiritual thing. I pray, and I believe that, my higher power talks to me through you guys and coming to these meetings. And 12, having had a psychic change / spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, tried to carry this message. That's pretty much, and practice these principles in all our affairs, I'm out of time, man. That's part of what I'm doing now. Another part of doing that, of carrying the message, is just working with other people, greeting people, making coffee, just really simple stuff. And the 11 is, I thought that was a really hard thing, but I learned recently that it's just not thinking about myself. So it made that one a lot easier for me. That's about all that I got. Thanks, Dan, for asking me to speak. This was lovely, and thank you for my sobriety, guys.